Today's Taisho will be on case 21 in the Mu Meng Quan, the Wu Meng Quan. It's case 21 is entitled Wu Meng's Kan Shiketsu. A monk asked Wu Meng, "What is Buddha?" Wu Meng replied, "Kan Shiketsu." Mu Meng's comment. Wu Meng was too poor to prepare plain food, too busy to speak from notes. He hurriedly took up shiketsu to support the way. The decline of Buddhism was thus foreshadowed. Mu Meng's verse, lightning flashing, sparks shooting, a moment's blinking, missed forever. Let me just say a little bit about the koan here. Wu Meng is the Japanese version of Yunmen. So basically this is Master Cloud Gate, the great Zen teacher, Chinese Zen teacher Cloud Gate, Yunmen. A monk asked Master Yunmen, "What is Buddha?" And Yunmen said, now it says here, Kan Shiketsu. Kan Shiketsu. So Kan Shiketsu means shit stick. But for some reason they didn't want to put that in the book. So they said, let's be nice about this and say Kan Shiketsu. Okay, so shit shouldn't be in a Zen book, you know. So we'll say Kan Shiketsu and we'll let somebody, and then it hints. It says in the notes that it does say shit stick. It keeps it down in the bottom of the page. And so it's sort of off the center of the page. I should explain that, toilet paper is quite a new innovation. Someday, people might be astounded that we cut down trees and made paper so we could wipe our asses, you know. It might just seem like an extraordinary extravagance. My mother, who I mentioned, was very poor. They had an outhouse. They didn't have a toilet. And they lived in upstate New York, so basically in the winter, You would go into there was like a room off the kitchen where you put your boots and your coat and stuff. And when you had to use the facilities, as we say now, you would go out and you'd get all bundled up, right? And you'd grab the toilet seat and you'd take it out with you and you'd put it in the outhouse because it would be like, where my mother's from, it gets to be like 30 below zero, right? So your butt might stick to the toilet seat. So you take it out with you and you bring it back in, you know. And my mother said basically that they used to have, they would never have used good paper to wipe their butts. They used to use long before the internet, let me explain that. You know, you still get catalogs in the mail, right? Some of you get like Land's End catalogs every week, you know. At least I do. I get a catalog every day from Land's End. And we have not yet gotten our catalog choice website hasn't been activated, so they're still sending us this junk. Basically, in the catalog, there's all these beautiful people wearing these beautiful clothes. Well, there used to be just one catalog like that. It was called the Sears catalog. Long ago, before any of you were born, Sears was the biggest and the, really almost the only department store in the United States. And back, you know, this has been true for 100 years, the Sears catalog would go out each season, and it would be like a phone book full of stuff, right? And anyway, in my mother's farm, they had the Sears catalog in the outhouse. So you could read the Sears catalog and then tear off a page and use it to wipe yourself. Yeah? And for most of human history, of course, people have used their hand. Yeah? This is almost, I don't know, maybe you're relaxed with that idea, but for many people in the modern world, that's like almost a terrifying idea, you know. But I myself have wiped myself with my hand many times, as a matter of fact. I don't do it now, just so you know. And I wash my hands in the kitchen every time I go in. But I use toilet paper too. I'm not recommending that. Okay. However, I'll never forget going to Mexico. And in northern Mexico, they have toilets, but they have no seats. So actually, you're not supposed to really sit down on the toilet. You're supposed to squat on the toilet. And in southern Mexico, there's a hole in the ground. So I remember when I first got my first trip to Mexico, I said, "Where's the, you know, dónde está, like, where, you know, the bathroom?" And you know, somebody pointed it out, and then where are the seats, you know? And then I got in there and I started, "Wait, where's the paper?" You know? "Oh my God, there's no paper in this place," right? You know? But, you know, people wash their hands after they wipe themselves. And, you know, basically, we have a lot of, this is like, if you're from a certain, if you're from the West, and probably many parts of the modern world, this is like funny, and it's also like deeply nerve-wracking, right? One of the first lessons you learn, and you don't remember the lesson because it's taught so early, is that you don't handle your feces, you know. This is like a very, very basic, and it's a source of anxiety, right? Source of a big anxiety. If you've ever gone into an Indian restaurant, you'll notice that a lot of people eat with their hands, right? And I myself have been to social functions, usually in the Sri Lankan community, and, you know, I remember the first time I sat down to eat, you know, it's like, "Well, where's the silverware?" You know? Everybody's, you know, they take the rice and they make a little ball and they put the dal on it, you know. And it's like, it made me profoundly uneasy to stick my fingers in the food, you know. It was like terrifying almost, you know. Maybe this says something about me, but, you know, one of the first lessons we learn as little kids is you never touch, don't play with your food, right? You use a fork. So there's an extension, right? You don't touch the food. The food can touch your mouth, right? You're not supposed to touch the food. You're supposed to reach then the fork, and you put the food on the fork, and then you put it in your mouth, right? So there's a kind of distance, right? We don't mind picking up a hamburger, but if you think about it, there's no difference between picking up a hamburger and taking some rice and some dal and sticking it in your mouth. But there's something I've noticed other people from like America getting a little uneasy when they have to use their hands to eat, you know. The point is that we have, I think people have an uneasy relationship to their bodies, you know. And it's reflected in all kinds of ways. You know, basically, we're not really comfortable. I'm not excluding myself. I think everybody is, you know, it's not easy being comfortable with your body. And part of the reason is that it's our whole cultural attitude towards the body has created a lot of anxiety and a lot of ignorance, you know. This sounds like it's going to turn into like a hygiene lesson, but it's very important to have a healthy relationship to your body, you know, because really and truly, we're part of nature, and in a certain way, our bodies are like our most intimate connection with the natural world, and this is very, very directly related to Zen. You have to ask yourself at some point why we don't just sit in chairs, you know? I mean, why do we sit on the ground on cushions and put our legs up in these weird postures and hold our back straight and so on and so on? You know, I come from a culture, you know, that always thinks in terms of like the spirit and the body. In fact, in Western religion, there's a common contrast is made between the spirit and the flesh, right? And spirit is pure, and it's totally spiritual, right? It's totally unbodied, totally pure. There's no, when people think about like being in heaven, they think about being like in a spiritual realm where there's no body. And the body is like often even called in Western religion, like our earthly prison, our earthly shell, you know, and actually, this is not entirely absent from Eastern tradition too. You sometimes see this language in Indian tradition, and basically. Meditation is something we do with our bodies, yeah? and you experience your body in a new way, in a new way. And it's not always easy. You know, the hardest part of meditation practice might seem to be the pain, but behind the pain there's a lot of different feelings and emotions. That are not just about pain, but they're about how we live with this natural world. I don't know if that's making any sense, but I remember when my grandfather died. My grandfather was somebody I really loved a lot, and when he died. We weren't allowed to see my grandfather's body because it was thought to be too depressing to see a dead body. But my mother told us that my grandfather had gone to heaven. He's in heaven now. And you know, I think this is one of these lessons you learn as a kid that sticks with you, you know. And was raised to be very, very ashamed of my body. My mother was very strict about things like nakedness, you know. And she was we were never supposed to be seen by other people naked. When I was just a little kid, I remember I was in my room and I was undressing, and I was in my underwear, my undershirt. And there was some, this, we were living in an apartment in Baltimore, where my father was stationed. And there was like one of the workers in the apartment complex was like mowing the lawn or something. And he looked in the window and he saw me in my underwear. And I burst, I burst into tears. You know, I was so ashamed. And I actually went, I actually came out of my room, and my mother said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "That man saw me naked," you know. And my mother said, "Well, you know, that's okay, you know." But she had really made me very anxious about it, you know. I don't know. Maybe this is just me, you know. Maybe you haven't had these kinds of experiences growing up, but that little lessons like that, you know, made me very anxious about my body and about my physical self, you know. When I was growing up, I haven't talked about this, and this is really not about me. It's just I'm using example. You might get awfully sick of hearing about me, please understand that I'm just using these as examples so you don't think philosophy is not a good thing to use. But maybe you've had similar experiences, you know. My parents, you know, trained us to, you know, be modest and always keep covered up. When I was about 12 years old, I began to have skin breakouts, you know. By the time I was like 15, I think it's probably the case that I had the worst complexion in my high school. I had real acne problems. My whole face was quite covered. And I had all these friends who had these problems, and I would go to their mothers and fathers took them to dermatologists, and they would get drugs, and their skin would clear up. And my parents, being in their usual style, I'd go, you know, "Would you take me?" They go, "Come on, you'll be fine, you know, you'll grow out of it." And it was really, really quite bad case of acne. And I can remember, having to get on the school bus in the morning, and my face was, you know, really like breaking out all over. And I felt, I felt very awkward. I felt very, unclean, you know. And I would be in my shell all the time at school. And of course, people would make fun of me, you know. And that had an effect, I think, on how I experienced my body. You know, maybe you didn't have any skin problems when you were a teenager, but I still have skin problems. As a matter of fact, I was hoping. Everybody told me that I would outgrow my skin problems, and they said, "Don't worry. Once you're 21, this will all be gone." Well, 21 came, and it wasn't gone. So I'm hoping that when I get to 60, I won't have any skin problems, you know. But I always wash my face like twice a day, and I have soap that helps me a lot. I still get cystic acne, you know, sometimes. Before I got this new Clearasil soap, I used to have, I would just have to go to like a big meeting, and I would have to give a public talk, and I would get like some big eruption, you know, and I'd have like a big zit on my neck or something, and put some medicine on there and so on. So that was something that contributed to like. Kind of uneasiness with my body, and again, I don't know if you've had experiences like that, but You know, as we grow up, we all, I think, develop a kind of, maybe this is just me, but develop a kind of distrust of the body. And we're constantly, I think, anxious. And we're trying to be a certain way. You know, we're trying to be, in our mind's eye, we're supposed to look a certain way. Last summer, my wife and I went to the beach in Hawaii. And I actually haven't been to the beach in about 20 years, and I don't own a swimsuit. But when I had to put on a swimsuit and go out on the beach, I was a little bit nervous, you know, I have to be honest with you. Because when you get to be 50 years old, you begin to have like pouches of like fat that hang off your body. Really, you know, it's just true. The other day I saw in the papers a picture of, it was really cruel, you know, Clint Eastwood is 76 years old, and it says Clint Eastwood goes to the beach. Now, you know, if you watch the early Clint Eastwood movies, he's at the beach there with some beautiful actress. And let me tell you, when he takes off his shirt, no problem, right? You know, he's got, you know, a 28-inch waist, you know, he's got, you know, these giant shoulders, he's handsome, you know. And, but the guy at the beach was like a 75-year-old man in his swim trunks. And there's like these pouches of, you know, and they're not like where you would think, they're just sort of here and there, there's like a big pouch of fat hanging off his body. And, you know, this is a guy who's kept himself, it's so cruel, right, you know, in a way. It's like, look at this guy, this is Dirty Harry, look at him, you know. You know, I think we have these images in our minds of, you know, being handsome, being fit, and all of this is created by our culture, you know. We have a whole experience of body life that is shaped by some of these things that are like personal experiences of upbringing. You know, this is dirty, this is wrong. And we have personal experiences that have come from our culture. Like, you know, a lot of people don't feel physically attractive. You know what I mean? They feel they're too fat, or they're too thin, or their shoulders aren't big enough, or whatever. Not the legs aren't long enough, and the two legs are too long. You know. It's easy to laugh, but these are all part of our relationship to our body, and some level we manage to keep these anxieties under the covers, you know, but they're, or behind a closed door, but they're there all the time, and they're constantly affecting our behavior. You know, again, I can just think of being a 16-year-old kid waiting for the school bus and just dreading to get on the bus. Because I, you know, I just felt like I was a monster, you know. And of course, it affected my social life in a lot of ways, maybe unnecessarily so. And I know many, many people who have had issues with bulimia or anorexia, or have had family members who have these problems because of this tremendous pressure to conform to a certain standard of physical appearance, you know. It's not healthy. It's not a healthy relationship to our bodies. It's not psychologically healthy, and it actually, believe it or not, think you might think, well, what does, you know, acne have to do with the natural world, right? You know, what is, you know, what is my anxiety about having a breakout have to do with the natural? It's all one thing, right? It's like, you know, not being able to trust your body to be the way you want it to be is not. This is like nature starts at my body, you know, really. And the body just often won't do what we want it to do. So, you know, in my mind's eye, I have to give a talk at a university. The last thing I want to do is have a big cyst on my neck, you know. Maybe a big red cyst, you know. And it's like, ah, my body has let me down again. You know what I mean? Another example is something like this, you know. I have in my high school, I was famous, I think, for having the worst complexion in my high school. And I actually have, and maybe it's related, you know, I actually have like the worst digestion in the English department at Rutgers, you know, I'm sure. Now, I have never had good digestion. And sometimes when I sit down on the cushion, my stomach is really acting up, you know. If I eat something, I might have eaten it 10 times, but I'll sit down on the cushion, and pretty soon it's grumbling and whistling, you know, and it's like a little battle is going on in there, you know. Really. And if you've ever had the pleasure of sitting next to me, you know, you'll know I'm telling the truth, you know. So I'm sitting on the cushion and, you know, naturally, I mean, you know, when Genki Roshi used to sit down on the cushion, you couldn't hear him at all. It was as though nobody was there. You couldn't hear him breathe, and you couldn't hear him digesting, you know. You know? And Genki Roshi is like my archetypal Roshi, you know. So, you know, naturally, when I come into the Zendo, I would like to come in and sit down on the cushion. And when I sit down on the cushion, I would like to look and act serene, and I would like my digestion to be serene, you know. But it isn't often serene, or isn't always serene. And sometimes it's far from serene, you know. Like, I have to say, I think the food here is pretty good, pretty easy to digest, but I must say that I think there was too much chili in the dal last night. Because I woke up this morning with quite an uneasy stomach, and I have to tell you, the bathroom has a whole different look at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. That's not a criticism. I thought it was delicious, but maybe just a little too much chili. You know? But the point is, our bodies are not necessarily controllable either. You know, they're not controllable. And I think that having a healthy relationship to the world begins. Part of that is having a healthy relationship to your body. And having a healthy relationship to your body doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to suddenly grow 2 inches, or develop broad shoulders, or lose weight, or have a stomach that's very quiet, you know. It doesn't mean, you know, even though I always say Zen is good for your health, and indeed I think it is, it doesn't mean you're going to be like disease-free or something like that. I think having a healthy relationship with your body is much more complex than that. It has to do with being willing to open yourself up to this sounds trite, but the body has a deep wisdom, you know, and we don't listen to it. We don't listen to it because we have all of these experiences that have made us distrust it, Now, you know, in a Western religious tradition, the body is unimportant. It's totally unimportant. When we die, even in one of the sutras we say, and then when our bodies are cast away, you know, but actually, that's a not so. You know. I mean, the body is like a door to enlightenment. It's like the door into enlightenment. You know, in Western religion, people sit in comfortable chairs and they read books, you know. But in our tradition, what we do is we use the body as our instrument for experiencing the world. Our book is the body. This is quite interesting, I think. The body is like designed, you could say, for enlightenment. And it's designed for enlightenment even though you might have a lot of gas sometime, or lymphatic, even though I have a lot of gas, you know? Even though I have a lot of gas, you know? And even though I had diarrhea last night, just to let you know, yes, it's still designed for enlightenment. And, there was a woman here who came briefly, and then she left. She wasn't happy with the Zen practice. But I went up to talk to her, she kept looking at me in an odd way. And later I went into the bathroom and I had some snot or something hanging out of my nose. You know? I hadn't looked at myself in a mirror that day, you know, and when we think of the Dalai Lama, we don't think of him as having a lot of gas, you know, or having snot hanging out of his nose, you know, like a booger, as we say. You know? Yeah? So it's easy to read this koan and go, okay, shit is a Buddha too, you know. But we have an uneasy relationship with our bodies. And when we think about having a healthy relationship with our bodies, it's a very, our understanding of a healthy relationship to the body or a natural relationship to the body is very trivial. And it usually means having sex, right? You know? Or it usually means, going jogging. And by the way, neither of those things are bad. I'm not criticizing it. But those are very superficial relationships to the body, because let me say why I think that's so. How do you have a natural relationship to the body? And I think it's quite complicated, you know? I think it's quite complicated. Having a natural relationship to the body doesn't mean that you decide not to take a bath, a shower, during the whole session. Right? That might seem like natural, but that's not it either, you know? Genki Roshi told me that once when he was starting out as a monk, he went to this one temple. He said, I went to this temple and the first day of the session, he said, when is the shower period? And one of the monks said, oh, at this temple, during session, we don't take a bath till the end of the session. Which is very unusual for Japanese people because they're like bath obsessed, right? You know. So he said, oh. And Genki Roshi said, his face got pinched up and he said, let me tell you, after that session, I was out of there. You know, because everybody smelled really bad. You know? So I think we don't trust our bodies. And I think we have powerful anxieties that are caused by our personal experiences. And I think they're also socially produced. You know, so actually when they do surveys of people, in particularly women, but also men, they ask people, how satisfied with your body? And people are actually very unsatisfied with their bodies, which is really curious. Because basically we don't look like Carmen I don't even, I can't even think of an actress right now. Let me see. All About Mary. That's, anyway, you know the actress. Cameron Diaz. Okay. So anyway, we don't look like that, you know, or we don't look like, I don't know, you can pick your nail style. And that's, you know, we can say, oh, I just got to accept myself, right? But that's a really, really trivial relationship to the body, in my opinion. You know, when we sit on the cushion, I think we begin to have a very profound relationship to the physical world. Because spiritual life is, I really don't even like that word, see, because the search for enlightenment can't be done without a body. You know, actually the Buddha said that. He said, you know, even God can't have enlightenment. You have to have a body. And the experience of existence through the body is this incredible opportunity. And with all the problems, all the gas, the diseases, you know, sickness and old age and death are absolutely guaranteed. You know, my brother-in-law just got his hips replaced, you know. That's guaranteed for all of us. Cancer is guaranteed. But, you know, when you sit on the cushion and you experience pain, pain. And this is an experience of your existence as a physical being. And we have a range of, you know, one of our, we have a range of responses to pain. But, you know, one of them is anger, you know. One of them is terror, right? Fear. You know, so nobody likes being in pain. But I think also one of our responses is shame. You know, I think pain is, it's just another example of how we can't control things, you know. In my mind's eye, in the ideal world, you know, I look like an actor, and I put on my robes, and I come in and sit down on the zendo, and a beautiful body, you know, sit on the cushion, no pain. So you sit on the cushion, and you start having pain in your legs, and your stomach is upset. And maybe you have allergy, and there's all this irritation, and you sit there and you think, you know, I hate this, you know, I really hate it. I hate my indigestion. I hate the pain in my back. I hate all of this, you know. And we've tried to create a world in which none of those things happen to people, right? I mean, basically, when it's too hot, you go in the room and you turn on the air conditioning. And when it's too cold, you turn on the heat. And we have many different antacids, you know, at the grocery store. And I myself use antacids sometimes. And we have beauty aids. And by the way, I use Clearasil cream, you know, all the time. You know, but nevertheless, you know, there's a limit to the controllability of our controllability of things, and when we're sitting there in pain, you know, at a certain level of pain, by the way, you don't care what the hell you look like. Have you noticed that? You know, for day one of sashimi, people are pretty spiffy. You know. By about day four, they don't give a goddamn, right? I might have a booger hanging out, but I don't care. You know what I mean? I just want to survive, you know, sit, you know. Yeah, that's right, you know. And that's a very liberating. I'm like, oh, I think it's liberating. I think it's so liberating. Now, I'm not saying don't blow your nose, you know. I'm not saying don't wash your hands, please, science, wash your hands. I'm not saying don't use toilet paper. Okay. Those are trivial responses to what I'm talking about. But what I am saying is that when you sit on the cushion and you experience the limits of your small self, you experience pain, you experience fatigue, you experience indigestion, you experience whatever, sickness. You know, we say dropping the body, but actually that language isn't really quite correct, because the body changes, you know. The limits of my personal, what we really drop when we say dropping the body, even though it feels like we're dropping the body, is we're dropping that small self. And the body begins to be larger, you know? It's larger body. And basically, you know, we start experiencing things like bird sounds as you know, so intimate, right? So intimate. It's almost like part of, you know, Genki Roshi once said to me, you know, we listened to some thunder, and he said, someday it's going to feel like that thunder is coming out of your own body. And sometimes when I have indigestion, I think he's right. But actually, you know, actually, that really will happen. It will happen to you, so help me. I won't tell you the particulars of a koan, but there was one, well, I can tell you this. There was one koan where I was listening to the rain, and I felt like this is my own self, you know, and without any thinking about it. It was the boundary between that myself and the world had really disappeared. I've talked about this experience before, but Genki Roshi, his first Kensho experience was sitting at a sesshin as a 12-year-old boy. And by the way, Genki Roshi always had really clear skin. You know, I noticed that about him. And that, in addition to his perfect digestion, you know. And Genki Roshi, but he was miserable, you know, and because he was hurting, his legs hurt, and he was sitting on a cushion, and he just thought, I wish I were dead. In fact, he told me he wished an earth, you know, Japan gets these terrible earthquakes like China. He said he couldn't leave the sesshin because his father was the Roshi, you know, so you can't leave. He was adopted, actually, his adopted father, Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. So Genki couldn't leave, there was nowhere to go. He had to stay at the sesshin, which is a terrible way to train. Anyway, he said, I wished I were dead. I was sitting there praying for an earthquake that would just, the building would come and crush me and I'd be dead and out of my pain. So he got up and he went into the bathroom to take a shit, right? And as he was preparing, doing his robes, he looked over and in a Zen temple in Japan, there's an altar next to the hole in the ground where you take a shit. Yeah? And everybody shits. And by the way, you've probably noticed it, but everybody farts. Have you noticed that? Yeah? Even the Buddha farted. Yeah? Really. In fact, you know, I wanted to, when I went up to see Eido Roshi, you know, I wanted to impress Eido Roshi so much. I wanted to impress him, and I was sitting in my best, and my posture was perfect, and I went into Dokusan, but, you know, as usual, my stomach was bothering me, and as I started to sit down on the cushion, I farted, you know, it was like quite an audible fart, you know, and I'm like, shit, you know, damn it, you know. So even the Buddha farted. This isn't trivial. You know, when you sit on the cushion and you have like a lot of indigestion, as I do, you don't like it. You know, first of all, it's uncomfortable. And also, you know, we would like to be quiet, you know. I might be the only one in the room. And so all kinds of noises coming out there, you know. And what can you do? Your poor guy. What can a poor guy do? You know, when that's happening. You know, you can't go stop. I command you. You know, you can't go, Buddha, please help me. You know, it won't work. I've tried. You know. So all you can do is go into deep mushini, right? And boy, you know, I mean, you know, maybe I owe my Zen success, you know, to my indigestion, really. Now, years ago, a guy came into Dokusan. He said, I'm leaving. I'm not going to. This Zen is not for me. And I said, why? Really? And he said, because my stomach makes too much noise. I said, man, if I had felt that way, I would have stopped like two after my second session, you know. I said, don't let that bother you. No, he's gone, you know. But, you know, you go deep into mushin, and then the boundary of your body, that changes. And it's like, it's like, was that your stomach or was that my stomach, you know, really? And those birds are like part of my body. And I feel like the breeze is like part of my body. You know, really, I'm not bullshitting you. I mean, you have to ask yourself, what's this angle anyway? You know, why do I do this? You know, because I'm not making money, right? There's no seminars, there's no tapes. You know, you have to admit I'm working hard. So you have to say, what's this angle? You know, so I'm just telling you the truth. You know, you sit on the cushion. And a body drop, I shouldn't say body drop, this little self drops away, and everything is experienced as like this bigger body, yeah? And it's a bigger life, and it's a bigger life, beautiful. And then it's like, I'm in heaven, yeah? Really? So basically, you know, that experience can't come to you if you're sitting in a chair thinking. It requires, you know, the whole body is involved in meditation. The whole body and the unconscious mind, the whole mind and the whole body. These weird postures are, they turn a body into like a super sensory system, right? Like a... how shall I put it? A very sensitive receiver. Yeah. So those ancient Indian people experimented with body postures and state of mind, and they came up with these weird postures and basically realized that in a certain physical posture, you're a very alert, and your sense of self disappears, so you're no longer self-centered. It's like awareness without self, and you begin to experience everything as your body. Yeah? And this is heaven. This is like heaven itself. And this is like, you know, nature and man come together. You know, nature and human come together in this experience. You know. Another way to put it is, there never was a separation, but the imaginary boundary, which we started learning when we were told that your poop is bad, you know, that your body is dirty, and so on and so on. And it's a beautiful, the world is a beautiful body, you know, with all it, you know, okay. So this is what I would call a profound relationship to the body, as opposed to like getting a tan, and nothing wrong with getting a tan, I'm not criticizing it. Wet pumping iron, that's fine. You know, I don't do it, obviously. But there's nothing wrong with that. But those are actually shallow relationships to the body. This is a deep relationship to the body, in my opinion. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't take a shower. You know, please do. Now, after I had my Daikensho, one of the last things Webb Roshi taught me, we were doing a session on a farm that one of our members owned, and we were working out in the fields, and we would come in, and this guy was like a hippie, you know, so he had lived in what was called a zone. I don't know if you've ever seen a zone, but they're made out of triangles. They're like a dome house, and all the walls are, it was invented by Buckminster Fuller, whom you've probably never heard of, but in the 60s he was the futurologist. Everybody, all the hippies loved his work, and they built these incredibly ugly houses made out of these little triangles. You take little triangles and you keep putting them together and you make a big sphere, basically, you know. And he had a house that was a zone, so we were sleeping in the zone. Webb said, come with me. And this was during the break period. He sat there and he just cut his nails. He cleaned his nails and he cut his nails. And he just basically showed me his hands. And even, you know, his hands were clean and he had cut his nails. And there was no dirt under his fingernails. And of course, he didn't point out my hands, which were, I had dirt under my fingernails and my nails hadn't been cut. But I realized that I had to take care of my body because that's part of my relationship to nature, you know, is caring for the body. Caring for the body is not really different from caring for your garden. You know, this is all one life, you know. And by the way, you know, when people practice Zen together, I think one of the things that is one of the fatalities is privacy. You know, it's okay to try to preserve privacy. I'm not saying you shouldn't try to preserve privacy. But, you know, at some point, if you share a room with somebody, you know, they're going to begin to know you in ways you might not want to be known, right? You know? You might fart when you sleep. It's hard to prevent that, you know? If somebody sees you with your shirt off, I'm not saying we should all run around with our shirts off, you know? I'm not saying that. But, you know, there's a kind of... The barriers go down when you do this, you know, and you begin to, I just think it's true, you know, privacy is fine, but if you do this long enough, you realize there's no such thing as privacy. It's just, there's no such thing. It's all one life. It's all one life. And I don't mean I'm going to tell you how to live, you know, but it's all one life. You know, privacy is a kind of illusion, actually. Please have a profound relationship with your body. All of us have imperfect bodies, you know, in a certain way. And none of us is handsome enough or buff enough or... being in a body is a great gift, and beginning to realize that there is no such thing. This split between body and spirit those two things don't exist. There's just one life energy in all of its forms. Yeah. And we can't control it with our small minds, but we can become part of the unfolding of this life energy. And that's what we're doing here at Sesshin. Self-consciousness is always a sign, actually, that we're in the small self, you know. So please be modest and clean. But when you're on the cushion, drop the small self, and please experience this beautiful life energy. Okay. Umon's Kan Shiketsu. A monk asked Umon, what is Buddha? Umon said, shit. He could have just said, shit. You or your shit. Okay. Mumon's comment. Umon was too poor to prepare plain food. In other words, this was a, he said, this is a great koan. But he said, he hurried up, he hurriedly took up shit, a shit stick, to support the way. In other words, he was, he didn't have anything else to talk about at Taisho, so he talked about this. He says, the decline of Buddhism was thus foreshadowed. Remember, when Master Mumon insults you, he's paying you a compliment. So what he's really saying here is, this is really good for Buddhism. One last thing, and I'll quit, I'm sorry. But I don't know if you've ever been to a Chinese restaurant, you know? But if you go in, there's usually like a big fat Buddha, you know? And for years I just thought, how tacky, you know, this big fat Buddha, you know? And people rub his belly for good luck, you know? And I just thought, boy, that is so degrading to Buddhism, you know? And then one day I realized the deep teaching, you know. The monk is this is a historical bodhisattva, a person who really, you know, existed supposedly. And you know, if you say show me the enlightened person, you know, you might look at the Dalai Lama, and there are other enlightened people. You know, there's this guy. Lama Oli Nidal. I saw him in Tricycle magazine. He's a Scandinavian guy, and he looks like a model, you know, like a male model. He's so handsome, right? And his wife is like, these blonde Scandinavians with blue eyes, you know. Also, I saw a picture the other day of Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, you know? And he's so handsome. It's like, God, he's got it all, right? He's enlightened and he's handsome, you know, wow. You know? some guys have all the luck, you know. But you know, if you look at that, you go into the restaurant, you see that big fat Buddha, you know, that is so enlightened, right? So I don't care. I'm not worried. I'm not worried about the booger hanging out of my nose. You know, he's got a big belly. He's not like, let me hide this, you know. He's barely got his robe. If you look at the thing, you know, it's like the robe doesn't quite cover the belly, and he's got his tie. It's like, I don't care. It's all Buddha. You know, this is a deep experience of the world. This is deep, right? It's not in heaven, you know. It's not in heaven. That's a phony. That doesn't exist, actually. This is, that big belly is heaven, you know. Being able to walk down the street and not, you know, no self-consciousness, you know. Now, we humans have to, we are so dependent on the opinion of others. It's very hard to get free from this. But basically, in our moments of samadhi, we can really begin to experience naturalness, deep experience of natural body. You know, so, you know, please experience that. It's beautiful.